Haitians, he said, we don't need more Haitians. Then we went on and the president started commenting on immigration from Africa. And that's when he used those sickening, heartbreaking remarks, saying, those shitholes send us the people that they don't want. He repeated that. He didn't just say it one time.
Senator Dick Durbin, Democratic senator from Illinois, speaking with reporters today in Chicago. There will be profanity in this segment, not our preference here, of course, but you just can't do this story properly without it. Durbin was talking about Trump's comments at an immigration meeting yesterday, which Durbin attended. Lawmakers were talking about protecting immigrants from El Salvador, Haiti, and some African countries. And that's when Trump reportedly asked why the United States takes in, quote, all these people from shithole countries. And why not more people from Norway? A lot of outrage today over those comments, including from L.A. Congresswoman Karen Bass, who joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you. Well, you tweeted to the president that his language, quote, plunges our country back into the deep depths of history when espousing racism behind the closed Oval Office doors was not only permitted, but expected and encouraged. Do you think the president is a racist?
I do. I think he has a long history of racism. This isn't new. Since he started his campaign and called Mexicans racist, to the birther movement. I mean, there's just a long list of racist offenses. And so I think at some point we need to stop being surprised by it. It's just so demeaning of the office of the presidency. And frankly, it's an embarrassment to this entire country all around the world.
What is this going to do for America's image and for concrete policies, foreign policy?
Well, I will tell you that I'm headed to Africa next week, and I am sure as I talk to members of heads of state from Angola and South Africa that they are going to describe how abhorrent his comments are and the tone that he sets. What is extra pathetic about it is that it's completely inaccurate. And so Africans that come to the United States through the visa lottery process happen to be some of the most educated immigrants of all groups, and a large percentage come with college degrees.
Right. He does single out the visa lottery program. He said basically that those countries give us their worst people. That's what he said last month. And I'm wondering about this program because Senators Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin have proposed cutting it by 50% as a compromise to getting the DACA deal done. What do you think about that?
Oh, I strongly disagree with that, and I would never vote for anything that would cut the visa lottery. And really, it's a way almost, and I'm sure they don't mean this deliberately, but it pits groups against each other. And so there is no reason to put this in the discussion around DACA. The young people who applied for the DACA program came forward because they were encouraged to, should just be invited to continue to stay. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the visa lottery. The reason the president is attacking that is because he has no understanding of what the lottery system is. He thinks it's like you go down to the corner store and buy a lottery ticket. You go through a tremendous amount of background checks and vetting before you are put in a pool to then be a part of a lottery.
And why do you think he has singled out this particular program?
I think that it's just another manifestation of his racism, the fact that he knows that African immigrants come this way. And let me just tell you an interesting thing. The visa lottery system used to primarily bring in people from Ireland and a couple of other European countries. And it wasn't until recent history, the last decade or so, that that has shifted demographically to now include more people from African countries.
And what is the purpose of it? Why have a diversity visa lottery program?
Because our immigration policies have historically discriminated against people of color and non-European countries. And so this is a way of diversifying who is allowed to come into the country. And as the president said yesterday, he thinks we should have more people from Norway. Well, what signal is that sending? And I've heard that people from Norway reacted that they were just fine in their country and had no desire to come over here. But he is clearly making a distinction that he values white immigrants and does not value immigrants of color.
What about the DACA program? Is there any place where you would be willing to compromise in order to get that done?
I don't know what the compromise would be around DACA. The young people who came here through no fault of their own should just allow it to be continued. Now, what I do think should happen is that I think we should fix the DACA program, but then we need to talk about comprehensive immigration reform. But my Republican colleagues do not want to talk about comprehensive immigration reform because they don't want to have people become citizens, because they are afraid if they become citizens, they will become Democrats, period.
What about more money for border security?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't have a problem with making sure that our borders are secure. I will raise the question now, are our borders not secure? I mean, you're having negative immigration from Mexico. You are having immigration from undocumented immigration from the Central American countries. But if we would be more proactive, we would look at the reasons why people are leaving their countries, try to help those countries so people won't come here in the first place. But that's not the policies of this administration. This administration just wants to be punitive. His whole call for a wall on the border, he doesn't even understand how the border is. Otherwise, he wouldn't even make a recommendation like that. And frankly, my Republican colleagues do not want to spend the money for a border wall. They don't even want to repair bridges that are broken. Why would they want to build a wall?
So, you know, we began this week with this televised open meeting at the White House between Democrats, Republicans, and the president talking about immigration, and the president saying that he would sign whatever came before him and wants to ensure that DACA recipients stay. And we've ended the week in this mess. What does this mean going forward? Is an immigration deal pretty much dead now?
Well, I think that we are all hopeful that next week there will be some way to address DACA. I think, you know, we were hopeful about that. But in terms of the main thing that we have to do next week is to make sure that the government doesn't close.
Yeah. So is that going to put DACA on the back burner then, or immigration reform on the back burner?
I don't know. I am hopeful that we will be able to take care of DACA, but I really can't say at this point in time.
I mean, some have floated that that could be a deal breaker, that Democrats would vote to shut down the government in effect if there is no DACA deal. Would you go along with that?
Well, it's very important to understand that Democrats do not have the power to shut down the government. The Republicans are the majority. So if they want to pass a budget, they have to put up the votes. They are not dependent on our votes. This is about their caucus. So Democrats do not have the power to shut the government down. Only the Republicans do.
California Democratic Representative Karen Bass. She represents much of LA's West and South sides. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Despite the fallout from the president's intemperate remarks, there's still no question who's having the worst month in Washington before it's even halfway over, and that person is Steve Bannon. President Trump's former campaign head and chief strategist was ousted as chairman of Breitbart News this week. He's also lost his Breitbart Nation radio show on Sirius XM, and he's down a billionaire backer after conservative donor Rebecca Mercer announced her family would no longer fund Bannon's political agenda. Bannon's big crash came after comments he made in Michael Wolff's book Fire and Fury. So what happens now to the populist insurgency Bannon successfully pushed in 2016, especially with the midterms this year? Joshua Green is here to talk about this. He's a correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek and author of the book Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
Okay, it certainly seems now that Steve Bannon made a devil's bargain. He did sort of try to walk some of this back, some of these comments that he made in the book, basically calling out the president's son and son-in-law as treasonous and making all sorts of other comments. So I guess you would know as much as any, what was he thinking speaking this way with Michael Wolff?
Well, this is pure, unfiltered Bannon. I mean, this is the way he talks. It's not clear when the interview was conducted. I think it was probably a few months ago when Bannon was on better terms with Trump. They continued to be close after Bannon left the White House, and Trump would call him for advice. At the end of the day, Bannon is very Trump-like in that he has an enormous ego. He's a very proud guy, and really does believe, correctly, I'd argue, that he really was the architect of Trump's presidential victory and therefore wants to get credit for it.
But why didn't Bannon realize that this could be the outcome?
Bannon has a kind of a blind spot when it comes to talking about what happened in the election, what's going on with the nationalist movement. You know, the devil's bargain that I talk about in the book is essentially the ideas behind Trump's rise and his presidential victory were mostly Steve Bannon's. I mean, he was the one with a coherent vision of what a populist nationalism could be, and Trump was the vessel for those ideas. But Trump, I think, rightly believes that it wasn't just the ideas, that it was the force of Trump's personality, it was his ability to kind of control a media narrative that got him elected. And Trump, as we all know, is famously egotistical and insecure, and as Bannon put it to me earlier this spring, Trump doesn't want any co-stars. And I think the problem for Bannon is he was always out there billing himself, not just as a co-star, but as the leading man, you know, the Batman to Trump's Robin. And that is something that Trump is just not going to abide.
Well, it seems like a lot of people aren't abiding by it. And now, where is Bannon? He doesn't really have a sponsor, a money bags behind him. He doesn't have an outlet to publish his ideas. So now what?
Bannon's strength and his influence in Republican politics, I think, always stemmed from the public perception that he was doing what he was doing with the endorsement and blessing of Donald Trump, even if it was only tacit. Bannon would go out there and excoriate the likes of Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and make life very difficult and unpleasant for them. I think on some level, people thought Trump wanted him to be doing this. Well, now that Trump has publicly excommunicated him and just belittled him to the extent that he has with the Sloppy Steve nickname and going so far to kind of destroy his life and his business and his political influence, it's clear for all the world to see that Trump does not support him. And so it's not clear how the ideas, how this brand of nationalism that Bannon stands for is going to move forward in any context.
Right. So then what does that mean for the midterms then? And for a candidate like Kelly Ward, for example, she's a conservative Republican who's running for Senator Jeff Flake's seat in Arizona. Let me just play a clip of tape of her from a CNN interview.
He was never part of my campaign. He was never an advisor. He's not somebody that I'd reach out and talk to in any way, shape, or form. So it's funny that you and especially the establishment would love to tie me to Steve Bannon. But
your press release ties you to Steve Bannon. But why are you distancing yourself now from Steve Bannon?
I am distancing myself from Steve Bannon. He's made some significant mistakes, significant gaffes that are unacceptable to me.
Okay, so what does it mean? I mean, we now know what it means for Bannon. He doesn't really have any place in politics right now. But what does it mean for these insurgent candidates from the right?
Well, it means that this insurgent energy that has been coursing through the Republican Party for a couple of years is diminishing. And what you heard from Kelly Ward there is her kind of scrambling to stay in the good graces of Donald Trump, to do what he wants, to distance herself from Bannon, you know, in hopes that the energy she had within that Republican primary and the backing that she had from people, including the Mercer family, who used to support Steve Bannon, will remain intact and allow her to win. But I think that the real effect of this breakup between Bannon and Trump is that it's going to make life easier, slightly easier, for mainstream establishment Republicans in their races come this spring. I mean, one big concern that Mitch McConnell and the Republican establishment has had is that we'll see a repeat of what happened in the Alabama Senate race, where the incumbent establishment candidate Luther Strange lost to one of these insurgent outsiders backed by Steve Bannon. That was Judge Roy Moore. Then, of course, Moore went on and lost the general election to a Democrat, Doug Jones.
Although you could argue that in the Alabama case, Moore would have handily won had it not been for the news that he sexually assaulted young women.
That's true, but when you nominate these kinds of figures, you really never know how it's going to go. You can't count on them to run a, you know, professional, smart, idea-focused campaign. They tend to come with a menagerie of figures around them and weird views, and they're often not prepared for the national spotlight. And so it's a big risk for Republicans if they wind up nominating someone like Ward.
What about President Trump himself? Bannon had been out of the White House, but he had apparently been giving some informal advice to the president. And certainly you can see his fingerprints all over President Trump's views on immigration. And that has been obviously center stage this week, the president's back and forth on DACA. What's going to happen to his views on that without Steve Bannon whispering in his ear?
You know, it's really not clear because Trump is somebody who doesn't seem to have a fixed set of views or principles on almost any issue. I guess you could say that with the diminished influence of the hard right wing of the party, he might be more inclined to support a more moderate immigration deal. But I think with Trump, you just never really know. It depends on who he's spoken to last, what his mood is like on that day, you know, what the gang on Fox and Friends said that morning. It's not clear where his views are coming from.
And so Bannon, for now, do you know, he's obviously in roaming around in the wilderness politically. Do you expect him to come back in at all?
I think Bannon certainly expects to come back. There may be an element of denial there, but I'm told he was very excited that Trump, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal on Thursday, said that while he felt betrayed by Bannon, he didn't rule out an eventual return. Trump said, "We'll see what happens." I think the TV reality impresario in Trump knows what a fantastic plot twist it would be to resurrect Steve Bannon from the dead and doesn't want to rule that out. So we'll see. The one thing that we've all learned in the Trump era is you can never rule out anything, no matter how crazy it sounds.
Joshua Green is a correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek and author of the book Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Josh, thanks.
Great to be with you.
Lots of unintended consequences from that Fire and Fury book, or should I say books? Plural. The Wolf book is not the only Fire and Fury out there. A few years ago, another Fire and Fury was published, and apparently readers are buying it now, again, thinking they're buying the Trump tell-all. That's a pleasant unintended consequence for author Randall Hansen, who's here now. Hi.
Hello.
Well, what's your Fire and Fury about?
Well, my Fire and Fury is about the Allied, the American and British bombing war against Germany from 1942 to 1945. And it's a reconstruction of what it was like to live through the destruction of a German city. And it's a reflection on the morality and the effectiveness of the Allied bombing war.
Do you see any parallels with the Michael Wolff Fire and Fury?
Oddly enough, I do. A few people have said in the press that there are no parallels. I think there is, in fact, one, and it's an important one. When Wolff chose the title Fire and Fury because President Trump threatened to rain fire and fury down on North Korea, well, my Fire and Fury, my book, is about what that looks like in practice, about the effects on civilian populations of even a conventional war, about how horrific they are, and about how much awful human suffering is entailed in war. Mm. And the implication of that is that this is absolutely the last thing that one should blithely threaten, as the president has done.
So, safe to say, the president has not read your book.
Has the president read any books?
That is an open question.
I don't think he... Anyway, answer the question, Professor Hansen. No, I think it's a safe bet that he's not read my book.
Okay, so how was your book doing sales-wise before this happened?
It was languishing. It was really, in a sense, over. It performed respectively well, and more importantly for me as a professor, it was well-received and well-reviewed, nominated for a Governor General's Award. But the sales had tapered off. It was out a decade ago. I had already done another book in between called Disobeying Hitler, and I'm working away on a third project. And suddenly, because of this coincidence with the name, it shot back up in the sales and gathered what I think one can fairly describe as global attention.
And so you're doing pretty well now with the book?
I won't know precisely. Everyone, you know, wants to know what the exact dollar figure is. I won't know until I get my royalty statements. But what I can say is that it hasn't performed this well since it was initially out. You know, you associate these sort of placing in the bestsellers list with a book that's fresh out, getting all the attention. And actually, many more people are talking about it globally now than they did at the time. I've had calls from all over the world, and it's been profiled in really the world's best publications.
Oh, so you really owe a debt of gratitude, perhaps, to not only Michael Wolff, but perhaps also Donald Trump and Steve Bannon?
Yes, to Mr. Wolff, to Donald Trump, to Steve Bannon, and oddly enough, to Fox News. Despite the very critical things I've said about their president, they seem to hate Wolff even more than they hate me. So on Fox News last night, they said, buy the World War II book. So I found myself with a strange set of friends.
Okay, well, will you read the other Fire and Fury?
Oh, absolutely. I've ordered it, but it's horribly back-ordered, so it's going to take a while to get here. But yeah, definitely. I certainly have no ill will towards Mr. Wolff.
Quite the opposite, right?
Yes, exactly. I owe him a bottle of champagne.
Randall Hansen, author of Fire and Fury, The Allied Bombing of Germany, 1942 to 1945. He's also interim director of the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, why the flu is especially nasty this year and what you can do to protect yourself. For one, drink a lot of water. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's flu season, and it's really bad this year. Here in California, 42 people under the age of 65 have actually died from the flu, 15 of them just last week. That number is significantly higher than in previous seasons. LA County emergency rooms are more than twice as crowded as they were this time last year. And there is a lot of misinformation flying around about vaccines, about symptoms and strains. So here to clear it all up, to answer all our burning flu questions, is Dr. Jaime DeVille, professor of pediatric infectious diseases at UCLA Children's Hospital. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for giving this opportunity.
My pleasure. Well, first of all, a basic question. How do you know if you have a flu versus a really bad cold?
Well, first of all, influenza circulates throughout the year, but it really hits hard during the winter time. And for older children and adults, it's not just a cough, the nasal congestion, the sneezing, the runny nose, the fever, but the characteristic body aches that make you feel like you've been beaten down. That is what is called a flu-like illness.
And then doesn't the flu come on all of a sudden versus a cold, which kind of builds up over days?
Well, there is an incubation period. In general, 1 to 4 days. The average might be 2 days. And then it comes, it hits you all of a sudden. And the body aches is what really differentiates the flu from other colds that you might get throughout the year.
Okay, so a lot of us got the flu shot, and a lot of us still got the flu anyway. How come?
Well, the vaccine, first of all, is not perfect. When we say the vaccine prevents the flu, it means you will not get infected. The vaccine is actually better preventing severe illness or death, particularly in people who are predisposed because of chronic medical conditions. On the other hand, the vaccine does have efficacy, and it varies from season to season. Some seasons are better than others because the vaccine is made by an educated guess process, trying to match it with the previous year or when was circulating in the southern hemisphere. Best case scenario, you can hope for 60%, 70% protection, but this year might be lower than that. In past years, the seasonal flu, the seasonal influenza A, has been under 40%, 20%, 30% in average for the past 10 years, right about 30% in that efficacy. That means that you might still get the flu after the flu vaccine. However, you'll be milder.
Hmm. So the efficacy is whether or not you'll get it at all?
That's what the definition of efficacy is, right, whether you're going to get it at all.
So even if you have the shot, there's a 70% chance, given past history, that you'll get the flu. But if you have the shot, it just won't be as severe.
Yeah, you're 30% less likely to get the flu, but also much less likely to get a severe form of the flu, a lot less likely to land in the hospital or in an intensive care unit.
Okay, what if you had the flu? Should you still get the flu shot?
The flu shot is not just against one strain of influenza. There's two strains of influenza that circulate, and they're circulating right now. And those are influenza A strains. Also, there's influenza B. The flu shot has two of the influenza A strains plus two of the influenza B strains.
Okay, so let's say you got the flu. You should still get the shot because you never know what other strain you might pick up?
If you got the flu and you did not get the flu shot, it'd still be a good idea to get a flu shot because they will not protect, the illness protects you against the same strain. Let's say you got influenza A, H1N1, you're not going to be protected against the seasonal H3N2 or any of the Bs. So you still will benefit. And the efficacy of the vaccine for the H1N1 and for the B is better than for the seasonal flu. This is very complicated and it's very confusing. But
why don't more people get flu shots? Even people who are pro-vaccine, they seem to go, I don't want to get a flu shot because I hear some people say, because I think I might get some mild version of the flu if I get the shot.
Very common answer. I might get the flu after the flu shot, even though they get the flu shot before the flu season when influenza is not circulating. Most likely they got other type of respiratory virus that is mistaken for the flu.
Okay, so the flu shot doesn't give you the flu.
The flu shot does not give you the flu because the vaccine is just pieces of the virus that cannot give you an infection.
Okay, that's good to know. All right, so is there anything that you can do aside from, get your flu shot, but are there any other measures that you can do to sort of mitigate your risk?
Well, the risk of contracting influenza is mitigated by the simplest of measures, hand washing. Try to avoid being close contact with anybody who has respiratory symptoms. If you have somebody, a colleague, a friend that's coughing, sneezing, try to keep your distance. The best rule is try to stay at least 3 feet away and wash your hands after touching anybody or having been on any position to be at risk. So after being in a public place, touching things that other people might have touched, good idea to wash your hands.
Okay. And what about taking vitamin C or zinc or any of that stuff?
I don't think that it really prevents contracting influenza.
Why isn't there a universal vaccine? I mean, we have eradicated other viruses, or at least we have made sure that we don't get them if we get the vaccine against measles or smallpox or polio, for example.
For influenza, the problem is that the virus changes every year, especially the seasonal virus. Not the H1N1 hasn't changed as much, but the seasonal virus changes a little every year. There are efforts to try to find an area of the virus that doesn't change as much and will be amenable for a more longer protecting vaccine.
Okay, so
but we don't have it.
We don't have it yet. So in the meantime, every year we have to get a shot.
Every year because the protection wanes. And the earlier you get your vaccine, paradoxically, the lower your protection is going to be. If you were vaccinated in November, you'll be in better shape than if you were vaccinated in August.
Oh.
And in the elderly, recently there's been an interesting finding that vaccinating twice in the flu vaccine season prevents mortality more than the single vaccination. That's what something that we see in children. Babies under the age of three need two shots to be fully protected. The first shot doesn't offer any protection. It's only the second one, the booster, that provides the protection. And maybe that's the case in the elderly as well.
Oh, interesting. Okay, good thing to know. Dr. Jaime DeVille, Clinical Professor of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UCLA Children's Hospital. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And if you need the vaccine, we are posting a map of local vaccination sites on our Facebook and Twitter pages. You can find us there at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Liam Neeson is on a mission again, this time on a train. Our film critics review The Commuter.
I mean, it's really goofy, and you sort of take it or leave it. After a while, I kind of got tired of it. This movie is too long, I would say. I wish this movie was like, if it wants to be this type of movie, be like 85 minutes long.
We'll have your movie reviews next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. Maybe you're looking forward to a distraction this weekend from all the, well, doom and gloom, fire and fury in the world. It's time for movie reviews. Tim Grierson is back. He is senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Hello.
Hello.
Also back, Alicia Malone, correspondent for Fandango and host of Filmstruck. Hi.
Hi.
All right. First up, some wholesome family fun. Paddington 2, the second live-action adaptation of the iconic British children's book.
I've had a brilliant idea. I'm going to get a job and buy that book for Aunt Lucy's birthday.
Are you quite sure you're ready for the workplace, Paddington?
It's Phoenix Buchanan.
Dad's celebrity client.
I suppose you know who I am.
Oh, yes. You're a very famous actor.
VIP. Celebrity.
Or used to be. Now you do dog food commercials.
Oh, dear. Poor Hugh Grant.
Poor Hugh Grant. He got a BAFTA nomination, so don't feel too bad.
What do you think of this sequel?
I think it's pretty darn fun. I thought the first one from a couple years ago was very fun. I mean, both of these movies are super British and super cheeky, but they're pretty fun. It's once again Paddington with the Brown family. He's trying to buy this book for his Aunt Lucy. Turns out that someone steals the book. Might it be Hugh Grant's? I don't know. But so it's sort of like a crime caper kind of thing. Paddington ends up in prison for a little while. So there's like a prison breakout part in this movie. There's a lot of different kind of fun genres sort of thrown together in this movie. I think if audiences enjoyed the first one, there's no reason why they should miss this one. It does the exact same thing. It's really charming. It's really funny. And especially like the jokes in it. The first half an hour, 45 minutes, they're like these like throwaway gags that end up being important later in the movie. It's really kind of woven really nicely into the script.
So it can be for adults and children.
Yeah, I have to say it's such a life-affirming movie that I enjoyed it, and I feel like it's impossible not to love it. So charming. It's really sweet, the idea of Paddington as this character who sees the best in people. So even when he's in prison, he makes friends with all the inmates. He teaches the prison chef that he has a lot of talent. I just think it's such a sweet movie, both for adults and for children. And the cast, I mean, they're great British actors like Sally Hawkins and Hugh Grant, who looks like he's having the best time ever and he's making fun of himself, which is delightful to watch.
Oh, yeah. Hugh Grant. I kind of miss Hugh Grant.
Me too. I just rewatched Notting Hill and I was like, yeah, I miss Hugh Grant.
Well, it's funny. I feel like he's having a bit of a resurgence because I thought he was the best part of Florence Foster Jenkins. Mm-hmm. And between that and this, it seems like he's sort of reached like a middle-aged sort of period in his career where he's like, I'm just going to have more fun and not worry about being like the leading man. And yeah, he's a total delight in this movie.
Okay, next up, The Polka King. This is on Netflix, and it stars Jack Black as a Polish immigrant and polka band leader, and Jenny Slate as his wife.
You cannot go wrong with this man. He never stops.
We went in.
We all get rich.
I heard that people are investing money with you.
Yes, come see me at the show.
Great job out there, Lani. We did real good manage today.
Oh, nice and thick.
Nice and thick. My favorite size.
All right, Tim, you saw this one. And
I did.
What is it about?
It's based on a true story. Jack Black plays a Polish immigrant named John Lewin, and he sells knickknacks in Pennsylvania in the 1990s. And he's also trying to create like a music empire because he wants to be like the polka king of Pennsylvania. And along the way, he starts getting all of the locals to invest money into this idea that he has. Essentially, he's doing a Ponzi scheme. Mm. The movie is about how the Ponzi scheme kind of grows more and more and more out of control, and how he tries to kind of basically keep the feds from finding out about it and also like not disappointing his clients. You know, sometimes I think when movies are based on true stories, you think the true story sounds more interesting than the movie. This is that movie. I think the story itself is really kind of interesting, but the movie is a lot of Jack Black doing that Polish, you know, accent that you heard. Mm-hmm. And the character is actually not that well drawn. This is not a thing like Bernie, where Jack Black played this really true life character that was really kind of interesting and complex. This one's a little simpler. He's just sort of a happy-go-lucky fool who just wants to be successful and kind of convinces himself that it's okay that he's sort of scamming all these people in his life. The movie's not that funny. It's not that sharp. It's got a good cast. It has Jackie Weaver, has Jenny Slate, has Jason Schwartzman. But they all kind of feel like they don't have enough to do in this movie.
So maybe see the documentary instead, The Man Who Would Be Polka King?
I would recommend that first, yeah.
Okay, so more insightful, more delightful, even perhaps funnier?
And no one with a bad accent in that. So, yeah.
Okay, finally today, Liam Neeson is angry and he's on mission. Once again, The Commuter stars Neeson as an insurance salesman who meets a stranger on a train.
What if I asked you to do something that could profoundly affect an individual on this train?
I don't understand.
Someone on this train does not belong. All you have to do is find them. In the bathroom, there is $75,000. That money is yours if you do this one little thing.
I thought this was hypothetical.
You have until next stop to decide. What kind of person are you?
Ooh, okay, so that's Vera Farmiga, and what does she want from Liam Neeson?
Well, she offers him a tantalizing but dangerous proposition, which involves money. So Liam Neeson here is an ex-NYPD cop who's now an insurance agent, not making much money. He has a lot of debt. He's going on the train.
Why are they all ex-cops, by
the way?
I know.
Well, because then he has a particular set of skills
exactly.
that
that's
comes
why,
very
yeah.
much in handy later on. And you know what? I'm on board with the Liam Neeson action train. I'll get on board with anything he does, because I think he's so likable, and it's fun to see him, you know, take revenge and punch people and speak on the phone and talk about his skills. And then also he gets to, in this film, because he's trying to find a passenger, and that's his mission, has to put a GPS device on a passenger on this train, and he doesn't know why or if they're going to be hurt or what, but he just wants this money. And so he has to use a range of tactics for that. So you get to see the nice Liam Neeson, the funny Liam Neeson, the kind of Jimmy Stewart-esque Liam Neeson, and then the Liam Neeson, you know, out for
like leaping between train cars,
yeah,
and holding onto the undercarriages,
ridiculous things,
and all that.
And it's the kind of film when you watch it, it's fun, it's forgettable afterwards, and then when you think about it afterwards, you're like, it makes no sense at all.
Is it trying to be Hitchcock?
It really would like to be. Yeah. I mean, Strangers on a Train, there's definitely that kind of link to it. There's a little bit of like Murder on the Orient Express as well, mm-hmm. in terms of which person on this train, I have to figure out which one is not supposed to be here and why they're not. I mean, there's like an Hitchcock element. This movie's pretty goofy. I mean, it's really goofy, and you sort of take it or leave it. After a while, I kind of got tired of it. This movie is too long, I would say.
I wish
this movie was like, if it wants to be this type of movie, be like 85 minutes long. That's pure pleasure. At like an hour and 50 minutes, you're like, are we ever getting off the train?
So it's on the train the entire time?
Spoiler alert, not entirely, but by
the
time.
So like the other film, Nonstop, on a plane.
Yeah,
this is the same thing as Nonstop, okay. essentially.
Just and on
the
same train. Director, right?
Same director, yeah. Who is quite a skilled B-movie director. But I agree, it is just a little bit long, but it does know what it is, and it doesn't take itself all that seriously.
Well, Neeson, though, I mean, he used to be, I won't say used to be, but he was known for serious acting roles.
Right.
And so now is he just an action star?
Basically, I mean, he did that Mark Felt movie from last year that was okay.
Yeah, he was in Silence, wasn't he? With
Scorsese. He was in Silence, yeah, the Scorsese movie. So he still does the occasional thing, but it seems like this is very much, not only is it his bread and butter, I feel like he, when he goes on talk shows now, he does parodies of Taken over and over again because I think people know, oh, Liam Neeson, the older actor who's now doing just action movies. Like, that's the guy that he is now.
Right.
I mean, he's still, I think, a good actor, and I think he's perfectly
he's
fine.
He's not Oscar Schindler.
He's definitely not Oscar
not
Schindler.
Oscar Schindler. And I liked the action movies where he also melded a lot of his acting talent into it too, like in The Gray.
The Gray,
where he really had that sense of grief and he brought so much to that role. But he's having fun, you know? He's having fun.
Okay.
He's kicking butt.
You can't begrudge him that.
Exactly.
Speaking of fun, you two are headed off to Sundance.
Yes.
Is there anything in particular you're looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to a lot of the documentaries, like Generation Wealth, which speaks a lot about America and the rich people. I'm looking forward to Dark Money, which is a documentary about the dirty money going into the government.
So you're basically obsessed with money, is what you're
telling us. Obsessed with money and documentaries and dark premises. That's me.
There isn't a standout at this moment. For me, I'm always sort of having like fingers crossed going into like the next section. It's a section called Next, where it's a bunch of like under the radar things when you don't know much about them going into it, and then you sort of walk away being, oh my God, have you seen this movie? It's so great. And so some of those surprises are kind of the most exciting things that kind of come out of the festival. So I don't know yet, but I'm looking forward to being surprised.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to hearing about your surprises next time you're here. Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International, Alicia Malone, correspondent for Fandango, also author of the book Backwards and in Heels about the history of women in Hollywood. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A $980 clothes folding machine, smartphone-proof boxer briefs, voice assistants, smart speakers with screens, home robots. Yes, CES, formerly known as the Consumer Electronics Show, has been going on all week in Vegas. And Slate's Will Arimus has been checking out this year's wares. We're going to talk about gadgets now. Hi, Will.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's begin with this one that you wrote about, the Foldimate. That's the clothes folding machine. And for a mere $980, you can have some robot fold your shirts. Is that right?
Yeah, this machine to me is so emblematic of CES because it's, you know, it's the kind of thing where, sure, if that works, it would be nice, but it doesn't work yet. And, you know, it gets a lot of buzz because everybody likes the idea of having a robot do your laundry. But it turns out that that's a really hard thing for a robot to do. Every garment is a different size and shape and weight and texture, and teaching a machine to recognize the difference between all of them and fold them all in a uniform way is actually a really complicated problem, one they haven't solved yet, despite being back at CES for the second year.
And there's another one, a Japanese competitor that costs $2,000 and is huge. Does that one work?
The Laundroid. That one, I did not see that one at CES this year. As far as I know, this is still an unsolved problem of how to get a robot to do your laundry folding for you.
Okay. I didn't know we had that problem, but I'm glad that someone's trying to solve it anyway. What about smartphone-proof boxer briefs? What is that?
Yeah. So my colleague wrote about this and called it a Faraday cage for your crotch. It's basically, it's a wearable garment that is designed to shield your sensitive areas from any kind of radiation from your cell phone. There is some research showing that it can affect your sperm count. My colleague April Glazer, who wrote about this, saw this as just a sign of how much tech is made by men for men. That said, there also, you know, there is an increase in wearable tech designed specifically for women. There was a product at CES this year called the Willow Wearable Breast Pump that monitors the flow of breast milk and helps you schedule your feedings and all that sort of thing. That one, I think, actually got a pretty positive reception.
Okay, so how much of this wearable tech was there? I mean, we've heard in years past that monitoring your whatever heart rate and how many calories you're burning and your steps, anything like that, was the big thing in years past. Is that still a big deal?
Yeah, I mean, you know, wearable. What happens, I think, is there's this hype cycle where a new technology comes out and everybody is enamored at first with all the possibilities, and you see all those possibilities at CES, and you quickly realize when you try out some of the different applications that a lot of these are never going to go anywhere, but then you find the ones that actually really do have a niche. And I think wearables that monitor things like, right, like your heart rate, your exercise, people find those really helpful. And even Apple's big smartwatch, which, you know, originally the idea was, oh, this could be the next iPhone. This could be how we do all our computing on our wrist. Turns out that's not the case, but people really do like it for keeping track of their steps every day. And now it can do things like let you know when there's a problem with your blood pressure and you should contact a doctor.
Well, Apple sits out CES, right? They're not there.
That's right. And so CES for years now has felt that absence dearly, I think, because Apple is not only the biggest tech company in the world, but the biggest company in the world. They announced their products at these carefully staged managed launch events at their own headquarters. That works very well for them. And so it's sort of like everybody at CES is competing to make the, you know, the second biggest tech launch of the year. But this year it was interesting. The show, I thought, actually had a little more excitement around it. And that's partly because of the rise of these voice assistants. So you get them on your smart speaker, your Amazon Echo. Google has the Google Home. You also have them on your smartphone. So Siri for Apple and Cortana for Microsoft and so on. These are now getting built into every gadget you can imagine. And so at CES, we had refrigerators that you can command via Alexa. Say, Alexa, how much milk do I have left? You had a couch that you can talk to and have it change what's on the TV or, you know, show you who's at your door. Again, a lot of this stuff is going to turn out to be useless junk. But this race to build the voice AI that controls everything in our house is a big one, and it actually lured Google back to CES this year. Google was all over CES for the first time in years, and that gave the event sort of a little bit more star power.
Okay, we have just a minute left, and I'm wondering if you had a favorite tech gadget, cute, cuddly, or just really cool.
Let's see. I was very endeared by a couple of robots that are designed for your pets. This is something that nobody in the world needs, but there was one where you can shoot dog treats 6 feet in the air for your pet to catch. And it will also let your pet call you on your phone. So when it senses your pet's face approaching in the camera, it will actually give you a notification on your phone and you can look and see your pet. That's super cute, also kind of really dumb and nobody needs it. One that I found actually useful, especially here in Southern California with the droughts, is that somebody built a device that goes in your home and monitors your water usage. It uses machine learning algorithms to figure out whether you might have a water leak, whether your showers are too long, that sort of thing. I found that to be a really cool application of machine learning.
Okay, awesome. Hopefully we'll have it in our homes soon. Will Arimus writes about tech for Slate, and you can hear him on the podcast If Then. Thanks, Will. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. See you on Monday.